Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
These actions, latest actions by the government of Zimbabwe, are unnecessary and actually result in the U.S. government, you know, probably withdrawing their aid, and which will be very disastrous, particularly when you look at that, the fact that the country is facing a devastating drought, and now you have all this kind of behavior, which is unacceptable to these people.
The U.S. government criticizes the Zimbabwean authorities over the interrogation, detention, and forceful deportation of aid workers.
Let's stay within the frame of the law. In a nutshell, it's a great victory of democracy. We've been in the news the negative way. Now we are catching up. We are showing to people that democracy is something you have to nurture.
A former Senegalese prime minister welcomes the new date for the coming presidential election.
Investing in women's economic, say, economic empowerment. So you want them to be able to take, you know, smart economic decisions that will benefit society, benefit the family, benefit, you know, the home, and so on. But you need to empower women in those areas.
And invest in women, accelerate progress is the global theme for this year's International Day of Women. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Zimbabwe, the U.S. government is displeased with the interrogation, detention, and forceful deportation of aid workers from the southern African country. The aid workers, according to U.S. officials, were in Zimbabwe to support civic participation, democratic institutions, and human rights. The U.S. says they were verbally and physically intimidated by the Zimbabwe authorities. Samantha Power, the administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development, says the actions of the authorities, quote, render hollow Zimbabwe's claims it is committed to the reforms necessary for democratic governance and re-engagement with the international community. For reaction from the government, civil society, and beneficiaries of U.S. aid in Zimbabwe, Irish reporter Godwin Mangudia.
So far, government has not issued a formal response to the statement by the U.S. government. But what we understand now is that supporters of the ruling party are condemning the U.S. government for the condemnation of the deportation. And they are saying that, Zimbabwe has a right to do whatever they want. And they are saying the U.S. has no right to dictate what happens to Zimbabwe, especially in the face of having, you know, imposed sanctions on some leaders in the Zimbabwean government. There is a mixed reaction.
What has been the reaction of opposition and civil society groups, knowing these aid workers were legally doing their work approved by government in the first place?
In fact, that this is what shocked the opposition and the civil society. They are puzzled to say that the government can take the decision which they did, especially in the face that the United States government is the biggest donor in Zimbabwe in terms of health, food, agriculture, and everything. And they are saying these people were doing their work above board, and there was no basis whatsoever to behave the way they did.
God, we understand those recipients of this aid could be significantly impacted by these aid workers not being present and fear that perhaps the U.S. might withdraw the aid to Zimbabwe, which would have a devastating effect. But what are you hearing on the ground about this?
In fact, I've been talking to some people who benefit from the programs funded by the U.S. government, either in terms of health or in terms of food or whatever. Their fear is that these actions, latest actions by the government of Zimbabwe, are unnecessary and could actually result in the U.S. government, you know, probably withdrawing their aid, and which will be very disastrous, particularly when you look at that, the fact that the country is facing a devastating drought, And now you have all this kind of behavior, which is unacceptable to these people. So there are fears, strong fears, that what government of Zimbabwe did might anger the U.S. government, and they might have decided to withdraw some of the aid, which will impact people negatively.
What are you hearing on the ground about the reason why the Zimbabwean government is not officially giving reasons of its decision to take the action by deporting these U.S. aid workers?
What I've been trying to follow the, you know, the social media handles of government spokespersons, either in the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Information and so forth, they have not acted. In fact, I was speaking to one of the officials in one ministry. He said they have not seen the statement by USAID or by the U.S. government. But what I suspect is that they want to have some coordinated approach and not disjointed.
Godwin Mangudia is a VOA correspondent in Zimbabwe. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. A former Senegalese prime minister says a new date for the presidential election is a victory for democracy and the people of Senegal. Mimi Touré, a lawyer and a former presidential candidate, also says citizens are hopeful that the coming election will be transparent and credible. Her remarks come after President Macky Sall announced Sunday, March 24th, as the new date for the presidential vote. It was originally scheduled for February 25th. The president's second and final term expires on April 2nd, as enshrined in the Constitution. Former Prime Minister Mimi Touré tells me that there are lessons other African countries can learn from the fight for democracy and demands for the respect of the Constitution in Senegal.
I think that's a very nice victory of democracy, of the resilience of the Senegalese people, the youth and the women, and that's how it should go. That's a message also for our African brothers. Stand firm, don't accept regression, and that's the only way forward. Now, we do have two dates for election, actually. We went from a shortage of dates to an excess of dates. And it's like after the drought, the flooding, because the Constitutional Council said election date is 31st of March to allow 3 weeks for the campaign, according to the electoral law. So we hope that President Macky Sall will adjust. He seems like he want to go to election quicker than anybody, but let's stay within the frame of the law. But in a nutshell, it's a great victory of democracy. We've been in the news the negative way. Now we are catching up. We are showing to people that democracy is something you have to nurture.
Are you saying, Mimi Touré, that this is a victory for the people of Senegal?
Of course, and the people, for all men and women worldwide who believe in democracy. I think that's an African victory.
Is there something or lessons that other African nations can learn or draw from this Senegalese experience, if I should put it that way?
We do have to talk to our young people. Let's remember that 70% of the African population is below the age of 35. If you want to be engaged in change, you have to put the youth forward. We have to support them as older people. We have to trust them. That's what we have done here. And we, at some point, gathered all the democracy activists, civil society, intellectual, journalists. We had a front at the end. We call it the resistance front. And we stood firm. It came at a cost, but that's the way forward. Freedom is to be fought for. And that's what we have done. We have defended our democracy. President Macky Sall himself was elected peacefully, but he came up and changed the whole system. So one of the lessons is all Democrats in African countries should join forces in one front and defend their democracy and ask for democracy and freedom. That's how I look at it, as a lesson learned.
Mimi, do you think the Electoral Commission is ready to administer the elections on March 24th, credible and peaceful?
Of course, of course. This election should have occurred, remember, a month ago. So there is no problem. We're going to do it clean and transparent. And that's what we expect. So there is no problem. We used to organize elections as we know it, and that's what's going to occur. But we're going to remain vigilant. We have to supervise and make sure that our representatives are in all electoral centers. And I do think it's going to be one of the most transparent elections, actually.
President Macky Sall has been consistent on one view, that he will hand over power when his second and final term officially expires on April 2nd. Why are people doubtful of this?
No, they were until yesterday. Because, as I said, how can you imagine postponing election 10 hours before the beginning of the electoral campaign? I don't think it have occurred anywhere. Of course, from then, didn't trust his word. But now the game is over. He decided, to come up with a date. So did the Constitutional Council. As I said, we came from a shortage of dates to an excess of dates. So now they have to coordinate. Is it going to be on the 24th, as the President said, or the 31st, as the Constitutional Council said? So there is no problem. They're gonna coordinate. But the most important thing is we're gonna have election during the month of March.
What are the expectations of Senegalese following this announcement from the president that elections finally will be held on March 24th?
They expect clean, transparent, and just election. They just want to turn the page. They want to move on. They want to go to another stage with the new government. And as I said, people are talking about let's reform institutions. Never this again, ever. That's the sentence that people repeat in the street. We definitely don't want, again, this experience. And I think that's a very strong message for the next president and his government. People want to pursue their experience, their democratic experience. They want to strengthen their institution. And I think that's the next step.
Mimi Touré is a former Senegalese prime minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Dakar. The regional coordinator for Central Africa at the Institute for Security Studies in Senegal says Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso should consider seeking external help in the fight against threats posed by jihadists. Dr. Oluwole Ojewale also says it's welcome news that the three West African nations plan to form a joint military force to combat the jihadists. His comments come after Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, all led by military regimes, announced the formation of a joint force following a meeting in Niger's capital, Niamey. For analysis and prospects of the anticipated joint military force, I reached Dr. Oluwole Ojewale in the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
Well, if the sincerity of purpose, I would say, is a welcome development, the task of securing those three countries required cross-border partnership. So I think it's a welcome development. But if it is just to promote their quest for legitimacy, then there might not be much to really expect from that in the long run. Because, they are pushing against many types on different fronts in terms of consolidating power in those countries. One of the major challenges that have become a unifying factor now, although negatively, is this collective insecurity of groups, terrorists, and violent extremism that are moving across the border. So I think I would say it's a welcome development if it is to find a common solution to the common challenge of insecurity in the country.
Now, these military regimes appear to have come closer. They decided to withdraw partnership with ECOWAS. ECOWAS has decided to lift sanctions. But some people are suggesting that the reason why they took over power was as a result of threats by jihadist groups. So this is almost like a foregone conclusion for them to undertake. Your thoughts?
That is what they say themselves, that they have come to combat insecurity. But unfortunately, because they are also preoccupied with regime protection, coupled with the fact that there's low capacity in terms of military armament skills and capability to be able to degrade this terrorist group, by all available data and indicators, they fail woefully in that regard, because attacks have been on the rise, particularly in Mali and Burkina Faso for the past 2 years now, And I think it shows how bad they have really failed in defending the reason why they claim they came into power. So I think these approach and strategies are probably afterthoughts. But if they are able to rein in insecurity in the coming days, then they might have a justifiable reason for carrying out the forceful seizure of power in the first place, even though it remains illegal, unconstitutional, and illegitimate.
There's a school of thought that perhaps by joining forces and pulling their resources together, they could have a chance of defeating this threat posed by jihadist groups. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's an assumption, and the jury is not yet out. They've done it individually, and we've seen how far they've been able to go. Attacks have been on the rise in the countries, particularly Mali and Burkina Faso. Now, if they want to go the way of collaboration, then we also have to wait and see how far they'll be able to go in doing that. But the challenge is that they are pulling different directions. They need to consolidate power. They need to push for democratic transition. They want to put themselves on the ballot. And at the same time, they want to also combat insecurity. And, I mean, an important factor in all this is the fact that they also have to be preoccupied with regime protection. Because you don't know, you want to ensure that there's loyalty within the rank. Nobody is also coming to mount a counter coup. So I think these are the critical issues that distract from pursuit of adequate security governance to be able to secure those countries. So these are some of the challenges that they're facing. But the jury is not yet out, and then we have to wait for the 3 to 4 months and see how far these cross-border transnational is going to fare.
Do you think perhaps they might seek or they might want to seek help from the broader regional grouping ECOWAS and by extension Africa and even internationally to help with this effort?
It is in their own interest that they explore that option. They can't do it alone, and they don't have the resources and the clout to be able to do that. So it is in their own interest that they seek international regional collaboration at least, particularly since ECOWAS has a framework for doing that in terms of counter-insurgency and counter-terrorism. So I think it is in their own interest to seek external collaborations. These are about some of the most poorest countries in the world by every standard of human development. And I think the people are under serious burden of poor governance, which has concentrated power and resources in the state capital of Niamey, of Ouagadougou, and of Bamako. Anything beyond those circumferences, you can't guarantee your life and safety. So they have a onerous task to actually pursue as far as securing those frontiers are concerned now.
Dr. Oluwole Ojewale is the regional coordinator for Central Africa at the Institute for Security Studies in Senegal. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Invest in women, accelerate progress is the global theme for this year's International Day of Women. In Cameroon, a prominent scientist is calling for the economic empowerment of women. Professor Rose Lekki, a malaria specialist, is calling for more opportunities and room for women to realize their potential in society. Her remarks come as the world marks the International Day of Women on March 8. It's a worldwide day to celebrate the economic, social, cultural, and political achievements of women. Lekki has dedicated her life to eradicating malaria and addressing health inequalities. For more on what the day means to women in Cameroon and the world, I reach Professor Rose Lekki.
So this day is put aside to look at what women have achieved so far, but then to also look at the gaps. Where could we be if we're given the space as much as possible, where we could be? And what efforts are we making, or what efforts is the world making to make us get to that position, or that to occupy that space that really, you know, you can say sometimes really belongs to us, but we don't really get it. That's why, for me, International Women's Day is a day, it's not a day to go drink or what. It's for women. This whole week, like in Cameroon, what they've been having is educating women in different areas. A lot of education going on, empowering them, giving them the capacity. If they're not doing anything, they should be doing something, you know, maybe out of the home, maybe just inside the home and getting it out, empowering them economically, empowering them, you know, like we do in the science area. I have a consortium, the Higher Women Consortium. And yesterday they had a whole meeting with that's trying to see how they can empower the scientists.
So Professor Leke, what do you think the communities can do in terms of empowering women, in terms of government policies, in terms of creating the space for women, like you said?
Let's say, look at, just think about the health workforce, where I know a little bit about. They represent 70% of the health workforce. They account for nearly 90% of nurses, 93% of midwives, but they hold only 25% of the leadership posts in those areas, you know? And they often will experience lower status, lower pay, or even unpaid roles. You know, some are doing volunteer work in those areas. So you have to empower them to be leaders. How do we get these women to also come up to be leaders? There's so many of them there. And where are they? Why can't they be leading also? If you're investing in women's economic empowerment, you know, so you want them to be able to take, you know, smart economic decisions that will benefit society, benefit the family, benefit, you know, the home, and so on. But you need to empower women in those areas. And it'll come a time maybe you'll be realized that women really, when they take up this, you know, women's humility, the higher they go up, the more humble they will become, and they'll really be home women, doing everything else but being what, maybe I should say, what they should be doing more is, like they say, women's places in the home. They become more of that while doing everything else, outside, across.
I understand you are also encouraging women right from the grassroots to the university level. So how are they looking up to you, and what pieces of advice do you give them during this period?
Oh, if you ever look up the Higher Women Consortium in Cameroon, you know, these are scientists that, you know, the older scientists try to bring up. We do holistic mentoring. It's a mentorship program where we really try to bring up the younger scientists, you know, not to give up, because sometimes they get married, they get pregnant, they have children, and you see them not publishing, not working in the lab. Being a scientist is not easy. You have to do lab work, you have to publish, you have to do research, you know, you have to open mind. And we try to keep them because many of them fall off the path. So this is the job we do with mentorship, and we call our mentorship holistic mentoring, holistic mentorship. And so the older ones are mentoring the younger ones. And we mentor them not only in teaching them how to write, you know, grants or what, we mentor them in soft skills, how to take care of the home, you know, how to be the time, like, you know, time planning, how women are about time management. Time planning, what do you do with the home? We sit down and really discuss around a fireside different experiences in the home and how women can handle that. And I think that kind of networking for women is very important. And you see the women just looking and saying, oh, Professor Leke went through this during her career, and what, look at what she is today. Then if I can go through what I'm going through, I will get there also. And I also tell them that they have to do better than I have done. And I tell these women, you know, the more they're educated, their PhD, their what, when they get to their homes, they leave their doctors or PhD hats outside of their door, and they walk into their home as this African woman who has a home with kids and be able to holistically manage that also. That's the kind of advice I give to them.
Professor Rose Leke is a malaria specialist. She spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. The United Nations is criticizing the reported mass abduction of over 200 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, in Nigeria's Borno state last week. The UN Office for the Coordinator of Humanitarian Affairs in Nigeria said the incident occurred while the victims, mostly women and children residing in government-run camps, went into the forest to search for firewood. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The UN Nigeria resident and humanitarian coordinator, Mohamed Malik Fall, released a statement condemning the abduction and called for the immediate release of the victims. The majority of the victims were women living in camps in Gamboru, Ngala town, near Nigeria's border with Cameroon and Chad. Fall said the incident, just days ahead of the International Women's Day commemoration, was a reminder that women and girls are among the most impacted by conflict. He also called on Nigerian authorities to provide more job opportunities to IDPs within their camps so they don't have to venture out and expose themselves to gangs and terrorists. According to local media reports, details of the abductions are only emerging now due to the deliberate damage of telecommunications lines in the area by terrorists. Security analyst Kabir Adamu says he has been monitoring the situation.
It started filtering in early in the week. The first instance, we had about 139, and then later 350. It wasn't just one camp. It was about three camps. And so this difficulty in terms of identifying the exact numbers of persons affected. But we know the state government has set up a response team, an emergency response team, and that team is out there.
Neither the Borno state government nor federal authorities have commented on the kidnappings, and there has been no claim of responsibility. Borno state is where the Boko Haram insurgency was launched in 2009. This week, the state government said 95% of Boko Haram terrorists are either dead or have surrendered to authorities. Adamu says the claims may be true, but notes that many parts of Borno remain insecure.
At the last count, over 80,000 of the families and members of this group have surrendered either to the Nigerian military or to the Borno state government. So yes, successes are being made, but what we would call overall success unfortunately haven't been met. And number one is the ability of the government to stop this group from generating funding. I don't think the Nigerian state has done enough.
Nigeria's police force of about 300,000 is controlled by the federal government. But for the first time, the government and Nigeria's 36 states are seeking to create state police units. Security analyst Mike Ijeofor says that would be a step in the right direction.
We need to adopt new measures. That's why I was excited when the president and the governors, backed the establishment of the state police. Security challenges are local, so we must look for local solutions. The Nigerian police is too centralized to be effective.
However, the plan for state police units has critics who say officials could use officers for ulterior motives. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
As the world marks International Women's Day, women still face obstacles when it comes to achieving equality. The United Nations says countries should be ready to invest in women's education and economic well-being to eradicate inequalities. On this day, some African women are challenging gender biases on the continent by advocating for gender equality, the end of gender-based violence, maternal health debt, and discrimination of women. For VOA, Maureen Ojiambo reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
On this International Women's Day, UN Women's calls on investing in women as the best solution to face the growing crisis. According to the United Nations, if inequality continues in the coming year, over 340 million women and girls, an estimate of 8% of the world's female population, will live in extreme poverty by 2030. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the world reflects society dominated by men, and if the current trajectory continues, it could take up to 300 years for the world to attain gender equality.
Women and girls have made great gains demolishing barriers, dismantling stereotypes, and driving progress towards a more just and equal world. Yet they face immense obstacles. Billions of women and girls face marginalization, injustice, and discrimination, while the persistent epidemic of violence against women disgraces humanity.
Women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics have faced discrimination and underrepresentation. Anne Githuku Shongwe is the director of UNAIDS Regional Support for Eastern and Southern Africa. She says, despite women making progress in the field, the majority still face discrimination.
For the field of HIV where we are and where we serve as UNAIDS, the gender gap is significant, and it shows the injustice of inequality that this year's International Women's Day agenda seeks to address.
According to the World Health Organization, globally, a woman dies of pregnancy-related causes every 2 minutes. Expectant patients have, in many cases, been reported to have experienced different forms of mistreatment from health workers, ranging from verbal and physical abuse, neglect, discrimination, and abandonment. Harriet Afandi is a human rights activist from Kenya. She says maternal health should be a priority for all women. Her sister experienced neglect at a hospital that turned her away while she was experiencing labor pains.
It was now a declared emergency, and now she had to undergo a CS, which affected her sexual and health reproductive status until now, since 2019.
Afandi says if there were more women in the medical field, maternal health death rates could be lowered. She says society makes it hard for women to achieve gender equality.
I just come from a community where even breaking the barriers to women empowerment, it's a barrier itself. So currently, people feel like what I'm doing should not be done. And now I said I'll not be silenced because the world is changing.
Shongwe says, despite the vulnerability that comes with maternal deaths, young pregnant girls in Africa need maternal and reproductive health care services without discrimination.
Maternal deaths due to complications in pregnancy and childbirth are 40 times higher in sub-Saharan Africa than in Europe. Since COVID, we saw a huge number, hundreds and thousands of underage girls who were getting pregnant in the safety of their own home.
As the world focuses on visualizing a more gender-inclusive world, violence against women reveals contrasting reality. In Kenya, at least 500 women and girls have been murdered by their partners since 2016, and 10 lost their lives this year alone. Valerie Aura is advocating for safe space for women who undergo gender-based violence. She's a survivor.
Seeing so many women who can accomplish much, losing their lives in the hands of their loved ones, that means when one woman dies, that's a whole generation killed. That's why I started my petition calling the Kisumu County government to build and equip the safe houses that we don't have safe houses in Kisumu County. And so you don't have a place to point to the women that if you're facing these challenges, this is a safe place you can go to.
Education can help to unleash the potential of every woman in the world to create a positive change. UNESCO's Assistant Director General for Education, Stefania Giannini, says investing in girls' and women's education is crucial to improve their lives.
UNESCO study proves that investing in girls' education triggers actually profound societal transformation. And today, our message is quite clear and simple. Girls' education is a matter of human rights, but most importantly, it's also a smart investment for the entire society to thrive, because her education is our future.
According to the UN, 1 in 4 women will experience moderate or severe food insecurity by 2030. This year's theme, designated by the United Nations for the year 2024, Invest in Women, Accelerate Progress, emphasizes tackling economic disempowerment and promoting inclusivity. For VOA Africa, I am Moreno Jambo in San Francisco.
In Kenya, a security expert is expressing concern about the downside of the deployment of police personnel to Haiti following the recent agreement between the government in Nairobi and Port-au-Prince. Major General Charles Mwanzia says there appears to be a majority of Kenyans who do not support the deployment. This, in spite of the UN backing of the move. His remarks follow a recent agreement signed between Kenyan President William Ruto and Haiti Prime Minister Ariel Henry. The bilateral accord will allow the deployment of 1,000 police officers from Kenya to lead an international force to help restore security in Haiti. But Major General Charles Mwanzia tells me that the prospect of success are small due to gang activities in strategic parts of the Caribbean island state.
The Kenyans are aware that on the ground, the Kenya police will number only 1,000, will be outnumbered by the gangsters on the ground, and the force, despite being supported by United Nations, is bound to have heavy casualties. And this is a concern of most of the Kenyans, how the government would accept such a mission, which straight right from the onset would look like it's going to be a failed mission, just like the others.
From what the government has said so far, as a security analyst, do you think the Kenyan police would have the capacity to bring some form of or restore peace in Haiti?
The Kenyan police and the military are very highly trained on peacekeeping missions. And for this reason, Haiti, there is no peace to keep. That is one. Two, they are moving to Haiti where the language is different. The environment is completely different from where they have operated before. However, the government will still go ahead, and we've seen a lot of things happening with a lot of impunity and disregard of the court orders in this country. And we hope at some point the government will get to realization that it's always good to obey the court orders. And I suppose the Kenyans, to be very, very difficult to convince the Kenyan public to support the mission in Haiti. But I still say the chances of success are very minimal, if any.
So you think it will be very difficult, based on the recent court ruling, for the government to convince the people of Kenya to support this move, or the agreement signed between Kenya and Haiti, or for that matter, Nairobi and Port-au-Prince?
I do not see the people of Kenya supporting this mission, but however, the government will still go ahead because of the agreement with the United Nations.
Where do things go from here, especially following the latest development that gangs in Haiti have taken over almost the capital, Port-au-Prince? Where do you think things go from here, looking at it from the Kenyan perspective?
Now, first of all, with the Kenyans to land in Port-au-Prince, they require the host government acceptance, which they have. And this is the host government which has no control over its own state. So the acceptance of the host government of the Kenyans to step in Port-au-Prince and bring up peace, which is not there on the ground, where Kenyans have been set up to lose a lot, and they are likely to have high casualties on the ground if they attempt to come in on the agreement that they have been accepted by the host state, which has no legitimacy. In particular, the prime minister who signed is not an elected prime minister. The state which is accepting them as a host state is not in control of their own country. Kenya would need other coalition partners, not Grenada and other, smaller states. They need superpowers to assist them in order for them to get into the country.
Major General Charles Mwanzia is a security expert. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council that the conflict in Sudan has inflicted severe harm on its people, posing a threat to the country's unity. He warned Thursday the conflict could trigger widespread regional instability, spawning from the Sahel to the Horn of Africa and the Red Sea. Nabil Biagio has more.
The United Nations chief expressed grave concern about the conflict in Sudan expanding into a fully blown civil war that could destroy the East African country if not quickly contained.
We are deeply alarmed by calls for arming civilians and popular mobilization activities in various states. Armed groups are entering the fray in Darfur and South Kordofan. All these dangerous developments are pouring fuel on the fire for an even more serious fragmentation of the country, a deepening of intra and intercommunal tensions, and more ethnic violence. It is time to silence the guns and raise the volume for peace.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres reminded the Council of the humanitarian disaster resulting from the 11-month-long conflict.
The humanitarian crisis in Sudan is reaching colossal proportions. Fully half the population, some 25 million people, need life-saving assistance. Over 14,000 people have been killed, although that number is likely far higher. Sudan is now home to the world's largest international displacement crisis, with 6.3 million people seeking safety within the country since the beginning of the conflict, and another 1.7 million people have fled to neighboring countries.
Guterres also addressed the hunger crisis emerging from the Sudan conflict, which aid organizations such as the World Food Programme say is spreading to South Sudan and Chad.
Some 18 million people are acutely food insecure. This is the highest number ever recorded during a harvest season, yet numbers are expected to surge even higher in the coming months. We are already receiving reports of children dying from malnutrition. The United Nations and our humanitarian partners are doing everything we can to stem this suffering. But we are facing major challenges as we try to reach millions of people in need.
The UN boss also appealed to Sudan's warring parties, the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces, to observe a ceasefire during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which is expected to begin Sunday evening. During the same Security Council session Thursday, Al-Haris Idris Al-Haris Mohammed, Sudan's permanent representative to the United Nations, said armed groups and elements from the region have been drawn into the conflict.
Sudan is dealing with war, which is supported by a number of states by fighters and mercenaries who have been brought from various continents, including some neighboring states. This is exerting highly unusual pressure on the Sudanese national security to review our crossing points with Chad and Darfur, the possibility of finding an alternative opening and other crossings and roads, in addition to Port Sudan and South Sudan.
Sudan's military-run government agreed this week to let aid in from neighboring South Sudan and Chad. Aid organizations had criticized the government based in Port Sudan for blocking their access to RSF-controlled areas in Darfur from Chad. Aid agencies say hundreds of thousands of displaced people in Darfur need urgent assistance. Sudan's government said it will now specify certain border crossings and routes into the country from Chad and South Sudan for aid operations. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Mama,
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nabil Biagio and engineer the great Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, however far a stream flows, it doesn't forget its origin. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.